Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. I'm Austin Titchener, one third of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and I thank you for your indulgence this week. This is not the podcast that I set out to do, but it's one that I very, very, very much want to do. For many of you who follow me on Twitter or are friends with me on Facebook, you will know that Ambassador Chris Stevens, who was killed in Benghazi on September 11th, 2012, was an old friend of mine from Piedmont High School and my college roommate for 2 years at the University of California, Berkeley. He was an old, dear friend. Before he passed away, I think I would have described him as a good old friend. I had no idea really how close a friend he was until he died, and I spent the next several weeks, almost a month now, sort of weeping on a daily basis. There was just held a memorial service for him at the San Francisco City Hall Rotunda here in San Francisco for him, attended by dignitaries and family and friends from his lifetime. And I was honored to participate in that ceremony as a member of the alumni, the University of California Glee Club alumni, a glee club that had been directed back in the early 60s by Chris's stepfather. But one of the speakers on the dais that day was a man named Steve McDonald, who Chris and I lived together for 2 years in the ATO fraternity when we were at Cal. For the second of those years, we had a third roommate, the handsome and talented and extremely tall Steve McDonald, who spoke so eloquently and movingly about Chris at this public memorial. So we're here now. We've had just slightly enough to drink to be able to get through this.
We're almost there.
We're almost there. We want to just give you a bit of a tribute to our old friend. First of all, Steve, well done yesterday. By the way,
thank you very much.
You're not the performer of all of us. You've become a lawyer, and yet you acquitted yourself manfully up there, I have to say.
Thank you very much. I don't know how you do this every day. Yes, this is Steve McDonald. I am one third of the Triple Occupancy Club.
That's right. That's right.
This is my claim to fame.
I have to say, what's been most gratifying to me in this month since we heard the news of Chris's death is that the tributes that have come in about Chris from all over the world, from the people who knew him personally, from the people who worked with him professionally, from Americans who knew him, from Libyans who knew him, from people who were stationed with him, either in the Peace Corps or in the State Department, they all describe the same guy. This is what's amazing. Not one person has described a guy where any of us have scratched our heads going, who are they talking about? That was whether you met him 36 years ago, as I did in high school, or 32 years ago, as you did at Cal, or 3 months ago in Libya, that was the same guy.
34 years ago. Don't fool yourself.
All right.
We're older than you think. Pardon me.
Yes. I'll cut this part out.
Yeah. No, it's absolutely true. It was an amazing thing to see the outpouring, and it was both gratifying and just made you sad that we lost such an amazing guy. And, of course, we were struggling to find some criticism for this guy. We were trying to find some fault in his personality or his behavior.
Unfortunately, you found a few examples.
We did. We found a few examples. Some of them wound up on the cutting room floor, but but there weren't very many.
The last time I saw him was in 2010. I know the exact date. Was on July 7th, 2010. It was my son's birthday. And we were in Washington, D.C., and Chris came to see us perform at the Kennedy Center that night. And then we went out for a beer afterwards, sort of in the neighborhood where they were putting us up. And we were at the bar, and we had one beer. And I said, look, do you mind coming back to the apartment where we're staying? Because I know Dee would love to see you. I'd love you to meet the kids. And I know Reed Martin, and my partner, and his wife would love to meet you as well. So he came back to the house, and he... To the apartment, And we kept him up. We sat up on the roof of this apartment building in the summertime in Washington, D.C., drinking until about 2 or 3 in the morning, and we made him talk about himself, which is pretty rare.
That is not easy to do. You're the only one who succeeded.
We were just picking his brains about the world. So this was 2010. He had been stationed most of his adult life in the Middle East, so Damascus and Syria. Wait, is Damascus in Syria? I don't even know. Damascus, yes. Tripoli, you know, Jerusalem, yes. Riyadh, you know, hotspots around the world. And he gave us his perspective on these places. And he loved the people over there. He spoke Arabic. He learned the local dialects so he could communicate. He was a people person, and he loved being in that part of the world. He was just curious and fearless.
It was so amazing to hear the stories most recently, just in the last couple of years. And we would hear from him once or twice a year and of course, exchange our emails back and forth where you and I are being smartasses and he's being diplomatic in response.
But also a smartass in his way.
But what was particularly remarkable just in the last few days, meeting the Libyan ambassador and some of these other people, there is no doubt that they knew he was a genuine guy. And it's just as you say, he put himself out there on the street and wanted to meet everyone. And as they said during the service yesterday, everyone knew Chris.
Yeah.
And that's the way he was. And
I love the story that the Libyan ambassador told when Gaddafi was still in power, and he was stationed in Libya, and he was going to visit the Roman ruins that was a big tourist attraction in Libya, that is a big tourist attraction, and he was being followed by Gaddafi's men, and they were taking pictures of him and scaring the local tourists. But Chris was an old hand, and he went up to those guys, took their camera, started taking pictures of them, and then said, "Look, you're scaring people. You want some coffee? What do you want to know? Talk to me."
Yeah.
I mean,
amazing.
Just amazing that he was that guy who would do that. But also, how badass is that?
Who's more courageous than the diplomat?
Yeah.
Who doesn't have anything in his hand?
Yeah. And he's not a diplomat who sits behind a desk. He was a diplomat who was out with the people. That's why he was so...
He did both, but he preferred to be out there in the field.
Yeah.
And that was clear from the outset.
Well, and I said this was not the podcast I wanted to do on that last night that I saw him in 2010, although we had corresponded many times since then via email. I had asked him, I said, "You know, I would love to do a podcast with you." And he kind of went, "Huh?" Like, and I said, "No, I mean, I don't want to ask you any state secrets or anything." And he said, "Well, good, because then I'd have to kill you." And I said, "No, I want to interview you because I think it'd be interesting to our listeners because you, to me, Chris was always the walking, living embodiment of the liberal arts ideal. When we were at Cal, he took a course in every single department, didn't he? Like history, logic,
yes,
geology, Latin, diplomacy,
and then continuing his dramatic arts and starring in How to Succeed in Business.
That's right. And Lady in the Dark, a classic that doesn't get
Lady
done much.
Lady in the Dark, I forgot about that.
Yeah, well, most people do, but I love that show, and that's why I wanted to direct it. And he had a part in that, and he had a part, and he was in How to Succeed, and I directed him in 1776, too. And I,
which is why he went into diplomacy.
Because he had played one patriot on the stage, and he decided to become an American patriot himself. I said that to his sister. I said, when he went into the Foreign Service, you know, the American community theater lost a valuable character man and second baritone. So I wanted to do this podcast with him because of that, because I think that education that he has, I mean, clearly he was the man he was. He was an adventurous, curious, fearless guy. But he was an educated. His knowledge was broad and deep. He could talk to anyone on any socioeconomic level of any ethnic tribe in the world on any subject. I mean...
And any age.
Yeah.
Because he would go and hobnob with dignitaries and kings and everybody else at every level, and then come back here to the Bay Area and interact with our kids when they were little. Yeah. And then at every age, and then we heard those stories again yesterday, when my son Eddie was 15 and he's having dinner here, I walk into the kitchen and Chris starts up a conversation. So you're going to be driving soon. You should buy a used police car because they go fast and you can run barricades with them. Thanks, Uncle Chris. And then we heard the same thing yesterday, right?
Yeah.
When who was it said?
It's his sister or his brother, right?
Yeah. Take him to see the armored car in the Marine. You know, they don't care about all this other stuff. Who cares about the ruins?
Yeah. No, let's take and see the cool stuff. Yeah. Well, he was all, and as you say, it was a rare thing for us to get him to talk about himself because he was always the guy saying, "Well, what do you think?
Yeah.
What's your opinion? Where do you stand? How will this affect you?" That video that he did for the State Department, you know, introducing himself to the people of Libya, talked about the very first thing they were going to do is just get the passports flowing so people could come over and study here and learn about American values, whatever that means. But not in the political italicized sense, but genuine, this is what it's like over here. And it's great.
And it didn't surprise me when I heard that one of the reasons he was in Benghazi was to help dedicate that cultural center and a space that was just intended as sort of a neutral space that featured American icons, entertainment, books, and what have you.
Yeah.
In sort of a non-confrontational way.
Yeah.
Which is always what he wanted. He wanted to enhance communication for everyone.
Well, he was always about people over politics. Yeah. He was nonpartisan. He worked for at least four presidents that I can think of.
One of the people he spoke most highly of, I remember, was Senator Lugar.
Yeah, who he worked for. Yeah,
yeah, when he was the liaison.
Well, and you know, the praise about him came in from all various sources, from Hillary Clinton to John McCain, who probably don't have a whole heck of a lot in common.
That's probably
true. But they said wonderful things about Chris.
About the limericks.
You keep bringing up Chris's limericks. I think they were mostly Monty Python lyrics that he would quote.
They were heavily influenced. Derivative.
Yes.
There's no doubt. There was that period when we took the philosophy of logic and we were both getting ready to go to law school and somebody told us that was a good idea and that it would help us think.
Well, we did shows in high school together. I mean, we were friends in high school, but we weren't buddies. You know, it's not like we hung out. But then we ended up going to Cal together, and we ended up rushing fraternities together. And I came to know him during that process, and that's one of the reasons why ATO became such a place that I wanted to be, because first of all, it had a lot of guys from Piedmont already in that house. But I got to know Chris during the process of Rush, and, you know, I had a pretty successful high school. I was pretty confident. I was pretty, you know, I was okay.
That's a fair statement, I would say.
Yeah. But you know, you're rushing a fraternity in 1978, and you don't lead off with, "Oh, and I did all the plays in high school." You know, that wasn't cool, that wasn't hip, and I was embarrassed. I was just embarrassed.
You did try to hide it.
I tried to hide it, and I don't think I hid it very well
for anybody. For a minute.
But Chris, they would ask him what he does. He said, "Oh, well, I did the plays in high school, and I played in the jazz band with the saxophone, and I played tennis. What do you guys do?"
Yeah.
And I just went, "Holy crap." I thought I was pretty confident, and then I got schooled in confidence lessons from Chris.
But there's confidence, and then there's confidence.
Yeah.
You know, we won't mention any names, but I remember trying to hit tennis balls with Chris, and, you know, he quickly discovered he'd be better off playing against the wall. And then I remember other members of the same fraternity who would walk around the house with their tennis garb on and a bag under their two rackets under their arm.
Yeah.
And he just wasn't that guy.
No.
He could probably kick their ass.
Yes.
But he didn't have to show anyone.
No.
He had that quiet confidence.
Exactly right. He didn't need to strut about who he was.
Yeah.
And also another great lesson on how to be liked. Don't turn the conversation around. What do you think?
Yeah.
What do you guys do? And then that was just another great lesson. And then it turned out we had similar dry senses of humor, and he had comes from an incredibly musical family, so lots of classical music, really good music. And then I had my love of musical theater, also another not cool thing, to be a high school kid going into college. But he knew all those shows too.
Yeah.
And then we had, of course, it was the late 70s, so of course there's a lot of Journey. There was a lot of Styx. I wrote an essay about my memories of Chris, and that song by Styx, "Come Sail Away." It destroyed me. It destroyed me.
You induced a lot of tears with that one. Nice job.
Yeah, way to go. Yeah. We did a play at college, Ionesco's Jack or the Submission, and it was very expressionistic. It was very surreal. It was very early 80s. It was very punk, you know? And my parents came to see it, and my dad's reaction was, "Whoa, why would you even do a play like that?" And I told that story to Chris because he saw it too, and he said, "Oh, well, I don't know about it. It just seems like a play like that, you grab on where you can and hang on." which
perfect.
And that's exactly who he was. He was always the first guy to, you know, if somebody said, "Hey, let's get up and dance to this ridiculous song," he'd go, "Yes." Good idea. If anybody said, "Let's put on these stupid hats and take a picture," absolutely, why not?
Well,
or let's go to this foreign restaurant or ethnic restaurant or a foreign country where we don't speak the language or know the customs. Yes. I mean, in improv and theater, we call that yes-anding. And that was the life he lived. He was the least judgmental person I've ever known, the least, and with the most reason to be cynical. He was the least cynical person I knew.
No, it's absolutely true. And I remember when he came in, he said, "I'm going to join the Peace Corps." And the next thing you know, he's saying, "Yeah, I have this opportunity to go to Morocco." And we look at each other, and Morocco?
Yeah.
What are you going to do in Morocco?
Right, right. You know? Well, and they said, "Oh, by the way, do you speak French?"
Yes.
And he went,
"Mais oui," but of course. And then he ran out and got a Berlitz course, and off he went.
That's right. You always say yes. Always say yes. Chris would be embarrassed by all of this, by
he
all of the attention.
But he would laugh. He would laugh at our foibles.
He would laugh. He would laugh, and he would be very happy that so many of his good old friends have come together. I mean, from all parts of his life, from his childhood to his adulthood, have all come together in celebration and praise of him. I mean, there have been, because of his lack of judgment and his nonpartisan nature. You know, I have literally in the last month had to stop myself because we're in the debates, we're leading up to the presidential elections, and I have strong feelings, and people have said some things that piss me off when they're politicizing his death or whatever, and I kind of go, I have literally stopped and asked myself, WWJD, what would John Christopher Stevens do?
Nice.
And he would.
Well done.
Well, and he, you know, he would go, take a breath, take a jog, have a glass of sherry. Watch a sunset.
Yeah.
As you say, he was very zen, you know.
He was, before we knew what it meant.
And
we lived in this fraternity. We rushed this fraternity. I think it was out of expediency, at least for me. Berkeley was a tough place to...
I needed housing, too.
Yeah. It's a tough place to find housing. And so here's this opportunity. And plus, it's a big kind of impersonal place. So if you don't find a connection somewhere, it can be difficult. You know, and kind of a lonely place, and certainly an intimidating place because there's so many smart people all around you. At least that's certainly the way it seemed to me when I got there. And I remember meeting you and Chris when we were first thrown together in this pledge class in the fall of 1978, and you guys were definitely larger-than-life personalities. And I, like I said yesterday, who in the heck are all these guys from? Every other guy was from Piedmont. They have some sort of automatic admission policy to UC Berkeley. But Chris was a guy that, you know, there were guys that were kind of tooting their horn or thought they were smarter than everybody else, and he just never was that guy. He just walked around with his quiet confidence and his wit. And it's like you said, his dry sense of humor. And it was so amazing. He just always wanted to hang out with them.
there's been a lot of great reminiscences from all of his friends and family, and there's a website set up called rememberingchrisstevens.com where you can read many memories of him and his life. The only thing that has, aside from how devastatingly sad we are about what has happened, the only thing that has angered me is attempts to politicize his death and turn it into some referendum about President Obama is unfit, or what was Chris doing over there anyway? Why should we even be there? I guess maybe some of these are legitimate questions, but I just in the wake of Chris's death, it just feels way too personal to me, and it feels like you should honor the man's service before you start trying to use his death to make political hay.
It's very disappointing and disheartening to see it, and you and I both have been struggling with this for the last month, and I think the only thing you can do is continue to speak out and show the world what an amazing guy Chris was, and just fight that. I really, when I prepared the remarks for his memorial, maybe I went overboard, but he really was an enlightening character. He was like a fictional hero, because there were just so many things he did. And when you read his website and all of these accolades, you felt like you were reading some sort of fictionalized superhero. But that's really who this man was and what he stood for. And, all we can do, as we say as lawyers, the remedy for bad speech in our era of modern democracy is more speech, and to just keep speaking out so that when the voices come out that are stating views that are nonsensical or unfair, we just have to try to correct the record.
Yeah, well, and speaking of correcting the record, things that has come up in the month since he died is there has been an attempt by, I don't know, just tinfoil hat wearing people on the right wing, extreme right wing, who have tried to say that Chris was gay and therefore he should not have been assigned to an ambassadorship. And therefore, that's a reflection of President Obama's unfitness to lead, and as if any of those things matter. I mean, yeah.
It was shocking to me to hear these things, and I don't know if the people that started this are right-wing. All I could conclude is that they were nuts or just malicious, mean-spirited individuals, or both. Mm. And it's so unfortunate that people have chosen to try to latch on to these things.
Yeah, and I guess keep going, wait a second, are we in third grade?
Yeah.
Is it the 1930s again? First of all, even if he was gay, and for the record, he wasn't.
No.
And also, B, who gives a shit?
Yes.
But why is that? Should this even be an issue? It was alerted to me by a journalist from the Huffington Post who contacted me for a comment because people were saying these things about Chris, and then they were my name had been brought into this because part of the evidence that Chris was supposedly gay was the fact that he wasn't married, gasp, and that I had said in an interview that we did musicals together, gasp, gasp, and that I had posted some funny pictures of us taken in our college days on Facebook, and that was being used as proof that we were gay and that therefore he was gay. And, and because I'm in the theater, that's ipso fatso, as you, I believe you lawyers say.
Exactly.
Yeah, that proves that I am gay.
How disappointing when they found out that you, in fact, like boobs.
Yeah, I do. As anybody really who knows me, I like boobs a lot. I'm sorry to disappoint anybody. But, I mean, it's like if he if he hadn't been murdered, this would be funny.
Yeah.
But he was. So how dare you kind of use all this and to say,
yeah, you know, it's so easy to put in a proper context and because of the internet and everything else, it's so easy for these people to take things out of context. So we could sit around and recite lines from any number of movies. You know, I know you're gay, you know, because you listen to Coldplay. You know, I know you're gay, you know, and we could do this all day long. And then if we say it in print or if we say it somewhere where one of these people will pick it up, then it's being used for this malicious content. Yeah. I don't think Chris's family would take any of it seriously or that they particularly care, but it was obviously very hurtful when we heard about it. And we can certainly attest from our observations that there is no merit to this.
Yes. How would you phrase that in a courtroom? There is no merit to these accusations?
Yeah, I would say.
I submit to you.
They are groundless, yes.
Yes, that we didn't have the tie on the doorknob. We had the rubber band on the doorknob. We thought that was a little more discreet.
After having met, I don't know, three or four of his former girlfriends and having them sort of, you know, looking cross-eyed at each other recently.
But no matter what we say, he could either sound defensive or it sounds like, oh, he has so many girlfriends, we're protesting too much.
Yeah.
You know, all I know is that if your only proof that of something is pictures from a college party from 32 years ago, then you really haven't proved your case there, Sherlock.
And it was the disco era, after all.
It was the disco era, and we were, in fairness, we were wearing ascots in those pictures. But I also had a cheesy mustache in those pictures, and those ascots didn't make me any more gay than that mustache made me Tom Selleck.
Do you know? Another quote does come to mind that I believe came from your dear wife, Dee. Mm.
Yes, Dee, my wife, had the exact right response when all of this kind of bullshit hit the fan, which she said, "Honey, you would be lucky to have such a handsome blonde boyfriend."
Yes. Yes.
Well, you know what? We were lucky.
We were lucky.
We were lucky, and I think you said it in your speech. We were lucky to have him as a friend for as long as we did.
Yeah.
And it's horribly sad to lose him. And both Hillary Clinton and John McCain have, you know, said it. We need more men like him. Not just in the Foreign Service, but just in the world.
It's absolutely true. It is the definition of an enlightened soul, someone who saw the way to proceed forward and to make our civilization work better.
Yeah.
And not just somebody with an agenda.
Well, yeah. And you said it because you were at his going away party in May when he went off to Benghazi to assume his post, and there was a going away party, and his mother said, "Why do you have to go over there again?" You know, as mothers do. And you said that Chris said, "Well, mother, I'm going over there for the better, you know, for our country, to make our country a better place." And he knew that making the world a better place makes our country a better place.
That's right. He said, Mother, I'm going over there to represent the United States interests in Libya and to help the Libyan people as they try to build their country into a democratic system." And she just kind of nodded. It was tongue-in-cheek, as we both know, the way Mary is.
Yeah.
It was very funny at the time. I have to say, also, share another story. When I went to that party in May, we came up with this brilliant idea to buy him a gift. And I thought of the game of Tripoli, which is a card game, and called around and looked online and found a toy store downtown in San Francisco here that sold the game. And ironically and perfectly, it was Ambassador Toys. So it was kismet. It was meant to be. It was serendipity. And so we headed downtown, and I ran into that store, and I said, "Do you have wrapping paper?" It turned out this woman spoke Arabic. She was from the Middle East, and she said, "Oh," and we were looking for other things that had some sort of Middle East theme, and she sold us a little pocket Arabic English dictionary, and so we were very pleased with ourselves when we delivered that. And then on a more difficult note, I suppose, when I was preparing for the memorial, Chris had written us a very thoughtful postcard several years ago, including an Arabic expression, "Rabana ya Sahel," may Allah make your time easier. And I wasn't sure how to pronounce that, and I was looking for someone who spoke Arabic. And I said, "Well, I'm going to go back to that store on the off chance that she's there." And she was there.
Oh my God!
6 months later, or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and she helped me a little bit, and I did learn from the Libyan ambassador afterward. That was the first thing I asked him. I said, "How was my pronunciation? How bad was it?" And you know, he was probably being polite. He said, "It wasn't bad."
Well, and what's the translation of that phrase?
It's
may Allah make things easier for you.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I mean, which is a great expression, a great prayer. You know, may Allah make things easier for all of us in this time, you know,
exactly,
that we've lost our friend.
Exactly.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast. Chris Stevens dedicated his life to building bridges between the people of America and the people of the Middle East. In that spirit, his family has set up a website called rememberingchrisstevens.com, where folks can send written tributes or memories, and if you are so moved, donate money to a fund that will support projects that will continue Chris's work. That website again is rememberingchrisstevens.com. Send us your thoughts or memories, but no money, via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com. You can also post comments on many of our website pages, and you can post reviews on iTunes. You can interact with other fans at our website and our Reduced Shakespeare Company Facebook fan page. You can also become a subscriber to our YouTube channel or become a twit. Follow us on Twitter @Reduced. You can find easy links to all these social networks at our website, reducedshakespeare.com, where you can also check out our tour page to find out where we will be performing next. Thanks, as always, to webmaster Matt Rippey, a perfectly fine man in his own right, but certainly no Chris Stevens, Matthew Croke. You're listening to Claude Bowling's Suite for Flute and Jazz Piano, which got a lot of play when Chris and I lived together at Cal. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Nancy Kenny, who drove all the way from Scotland to see us in York last summer. So, no reason, it's just random. Special thanks to Steve McDonald for his friendship these last 34 years and his support, especially in the last month, and for helping me pay tribute here to our friend. And thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 307 921st of the Reduced Shakespeare Company.
I thank you for leaving out the parts about our 21st birthdays.
You are so welcome. This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reducedshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.